Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Stanislavski disciple, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And with me is a man who's been undergoing an emotional and physical transformation to play the role of FlixWise co-producer. It's Mr. Martin Kessler, everyone.
Hello, I'm a passive calf.
Passive calf. Martin, maybe next time just try acting. that's my favorite quote about method acting. And today's guest has been talking into a microphone for 3 days straight for her craft. Let's welcome back to the show, Miss Mariah E. Gates.
Thank you for having me.
Yay. So as you've probably gathered, we've all gone to great lengths to prep for this show. Hopefully we all found time.
I actually gained 60 pounds.
That's, yeah, that's a little overboard, Mariah, but we appreciate it. Yeah, well, yeah, we've all gone to great lengths, but hopefully we've all found time between daily CrossFit sessions and research trips to Pamplona to actually watch today's Sight and Sound entry. Number 53 on the greatest of all time list, Raging Bull. For those of you who are new to cinephilia, Raging Bull was directed by renowned American filmmaker Martin Scorsese, and in accordance with edicts issued by the auteurist advocates who govern film criticism, the director is generally given primary ownership of the finished product. However, in this case, I'm hesitant to refer to the film as Martin Scorsese's Raging Bull, given how much of the impetus for making the film came from the lead actor, Robert De Niro. In our discussion, we'll talk about how much of the credit for the film's success should go to De Niro's towering central performance, and how much should go to the director orchestrating the quietly observed character study. Then, for our second topic, we're going to talk more generally about the director and actor relationship. We'll talk about why we appreciate it when certain directors cast the same person on all of their films, and we'll also talk about some of the pitfalls of continually casting one actor as Muse. Lastly, for today's final note, Mariah is going to give us a little overview of her new podcast. All right, you guys, you ready to rumble?
Are we also going to discuss how this movie is, like, all about Thelma Shoemaker?
I imagine that will probably
okay,
come
good.
Up.
Okay, good. I'll take that.
Yeah, you got
if anything, I feel it's not Scorsese's picture because Thelma came in and made it so beautiful.
Can't argue with that. Cannot argue with that. First up, we have Raging Bull, directed by Martin Scorsese and starring Robert De Niro as boxing middleweight champion Jake LaMotta. The film's narrative spans over 20 years, beginning and ending with LaMotta as bloated, sad sack rehearsing monologues backstage in a 1960s nightclub. In between those bookends, we get a flashback to the 1940s, where the story of how Jake became a famous prize fighter begins. Through the course of the film, we see how his pugilistic instincts, so sharp and punishing, start to infect his life outside the ring. Throughout the film, Jake persistently seeks out conflict. Behind every seemingly benign comment is a veiled threat to his precious masculinity. We watch as Jake initiates fight after fight with his friends and relatives, all of whom eventually give up trying to reason with him. His knee-jerk reaction to petty jealousy and violence causes him to destroy all of his important familial bonds, including his relationship with his brother Joey, played by Joe Pesci, his first wife Irma, played by Lorianne Flax, and his second wife Vicky, played by Kathy Moriarty. By the time we flash forward back to the 1960s, Jake is fat and alone, a tragic figure undone by narcissism and anger. By the way, Fat and Alone, the Lady P story, on bookshelves this winter. Raging Bull is considered by many to be the crowning achievement in the Martin Scorsese-Robert De Niro partnership. The stunning black and white photography and the exquisitely choreographed fight sequences are a sight to behold. And, of course, the way that De Niro embodied Jake LaMotta is widely regarded to be one of the finest performances in all of cinema, a benchmark by which even contemporary performances are measured. But at the same time, this is a movie about an unrelentingly cruel man, and I've personally had multiple people tell me that they have a strong aversion to this film. But what do today's panelists make of the highest-rated sports flick on the Sight and Sound poll? Let's find out. All right, where to begin? Martin, I'm gonna start with you. Raging Bull. Do you like Raging Bull?
Well, it's not my favorite black and white American directed film from 1980 with the name of an animal in title where the main character says, "I'm not an animal," towards the end of the film.
Same! But, okay. Same! I had the same thought. You stole my thought.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Like you said, there's a strong sense of craft and technique in this film. You know, I really like the editing, the sound I really love, the photography, mm-hmm. It's beautiful, but... as a whole, like, the story and the way it's told, I don't connect with it, like, really at all. I think it's sort of a character piece about a character who you understand very quickly. You know, you get that he can't turn off the fighting when he's out of the ring. So I think it's sort of thematically simplistic. It's, you know, you understand it very early in the film. And everything following is sort of a repeat of the same beats with the minor modulation, I think. So it kind of feels like a protracted short film to me. Mm. I just don't connect with it, you know. I don't really have the urge to return to it, and I don't know, it's also one of those films that kind of gets to me, films that substitute yelling and crying for drama.
That
always kind of drives me up the walls, but
yeah,
that's kind of where I stand with this film.
All right, Gauntlet Throne, Mariah. What do you think of Raging Bull?
So when I first saw this movie, it was right before I went to film school, and I was watching all of the combined AFI list films. Mm-hmm. This was before I was really aware of the bias in great lists and didn't realize or didn't think about the fact that there were no women directors in either of those lists. And so that was, you know, but whatever. I used them as a primary. And I watched this film with my mom, who either had never seen it or hadn't seen it since it was new. And so she was really excited, and we sat and watched it, and we were like, we loved it. When it was over, we were like, whoa, our minds were blown. Right. So I've been going around for the last 5 years thinking I loved this movie. Hadn't revisited it. I even had a DVD that I bought that I had never opened from the shrink wrap, mm-hmm. until today. Right. So I've had this DVD for like 5 years. So I opened it, I put it in, I watched the movie, and I hated it. And I couldn't believe how much I hated it. And I loved the filmic technique, and which is, I answered somebody's question about like women who like Scorsese the other day on Twitter, mm-hmm. saying, I love his technique. Like, mm-hmm. he's a master of filmic technique, right? He's like a master painter. He knows how to use a camera, how to use editing, how to use actors. Like, he's great.
Yeah.
This movie is technically great, but I still hate it.
Yeah.
I hate that it focuses on this. It tries to focus empathy on a man that I can't empathize with. And I don't know if he, like, there's no judgment, because that's Scorsese. He just gives you and doesn't tell you how to feel. But at the same time, I at least want to kind of care about the character. Mm-hmm. And so I find that hard. And then the fact that, like, he barely focuses on these women that he's abusing,
mm-hmm.
just pisses me off. And I know we're going to get to that. But, like, I would much rather tell the story of these women that got away from him,
mm-hmm.
and how hard that must have been for them, especially in the mid-century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, that's way more interesting to me than this jerk.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I kind of just disagree a little bit. Like, I do think Martin Scorsese is asking us to feel empathy for this guy. If not empathy, at least pity or sympathy. It's asking us to connect with him.
I got nothing.
Yeah, not so much. No, huh?
And so, yeah. And to follow up on Martin's veiled reference to the Elephant Man, mm-hmm. I looked up. I love the Elephant Man.
Yeah,
it's one of my all-time favorite movies. It's my favorite Lynch movie.
Oh, mine too.
I love it to pieces. Yeah. I looked up where it ranked. Do you know where it ranked
on the
same
sound
list? Yeah.
No, is it on there?
No,
yeah.
It was 447th among critics and 322nd among directors.
Yeah.
And I just want to punch everyone in the face. Like, you're all wrong. You all need to rewatch this movie. Yeah. Like, oh, The Elephant Man is so much better.
Violence is not the answer. Have we learned nothing?
Anyways.
Let's first talk about where the movie succeeds. I know we've all kind of touched on it, and it's really in the craft, in the editing, the cinematography, the sound design. And I know, Mariah, I'm going to, this is now your opportunity to expound on the greatness of Thelma Shoemaker.
Oh man, she's so good. I think if I remember correctly, this is the first one she popped on since his first film, right?
Yeah.
She's such a good editor and she's such a visual, like her cuts are so quick. Like I was trying to screenshot some things and it just cut so fast that I couldn't even do it. And I was like, I love this. And her, the way she mm-hmm. builds tension throughout the film mm-hmm. is beautiful. And she won her Oscar for this mm-hmm. and her first Oscar. And mm-hmm. I feel like it and the best actor, like, okay, I'm all right with that. Except that I want John Hurt to win that Oscar mm-hmm. instead, even though I wasn't born yet. The little cells yeah. in my mom's body that were me were like voting for John Hurt in 1980. but
already filling out an Oscar yeah. ballot. I love it.
You know, talk about working through makeup, like Jesus. Sorry, this yeah. is the wrong show. I'm all yeah. pro Elephant Man here. But like, I just think yeah. Thelma is the all-star of this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, the everything, all the superficial things, not that they're superficial, but all of the formal things are, they're, so, like I said, it's beautiful. They're, you know, like they're enough to distract from what I think Martin touched on in the beginning, which is that this is a character study, but the character at its center isn't terribly interesting. okay, well, let's talk about specifically how the fight scenes are composed versus the more domestic scenes. And, like, their contrasting styles. Martin, maybe you can touch on that.
Well, I think the fight scenes, like, there's a strong emphasis on LaMotta's subjectivity. A lot of it's from his point of view and the way time slows down or the sounds of it. It's almost surreal. You get the impression that it's more about how he perceives things. And the domestic scenes, they're a little bit more objective, but it feeds into, I guess, how much he's living in his own reality. He gets that sort of paranoid insecurity of, who are you sleeping with? Or you get a sense that he's somebody who's very much in his own head, I guess. And thematically, I think we were meant to take away that he's still throwing punches, taking punches. He's still fighting, whether it's, you know, with the women in his life or his brother, or even at the very end when he's doing the stand-up comedy, it's like, you know, he's still taking hits from the audience in the form of heckling, and he's throwing punches back as a retort. So I think we're meant to take away that it's really the same thing for this character. It's mm-hmm. he's always
yeah.
fighting.
Yeah. So I mean, it's effective. You really do feel like you are there with them. And I think this is among the first boxing movies to actually put you in the center of the action.
Except maybe
for
not.
Well, yeah. There's Body and Soul, which
and the setup
and the setup.
Boxer and Death, even Fat City from like early 70s. Yeah, I remember like there's that great shot of the fist coming right into the camera.
Yeah.
So I don't know where this started. That it's the first one to put you in the ring, because right. it's like not true.
No, he borrowed from every other boxing movie ever, basically. They all, I mean, there's more mm-hmm. shots, I think, of fights in this film because it's going over a 10-year period rather than like a weekend, like the setup. But you're definitely in the ring with Robert Ryan in the setup. And you're in the ring with John Garfield in yeah. Body and Soul.
Well, okay, so then the film's got nothing going for it.
No. Well, what it does have going for its fight scenes that these previous films, except maybe Fat City, but I haven't seen Fat City, so I can't comment, is that these other films were made during an era when music was used sort of differently. And you didn't have this like romantic music during a bloody boxing scene in the mm-hmm. setup. Whereas in this film, it starts with almost like a ballet style piece of classical music while he's, you know, jogging or whatever, getting ready. And it's like he's about to be in a ballet. And then the way it's slowed down almost makes you feel like it's a dance in several of the sequences. And then the music sort of highlights that feeling. Mm-hmm. And I remember either him or Thelma talking about how they were inspired by the dance sequence in The Red Shoes for these these sequences, and they filmed it more like a dance to get that sort of feel.
Right.
And you get that really with this, the way it's underscored.
I mean, it reminded me a little bit of the Kubrick, his Killer's Kiss movie.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, where you, like, you have the boxing, and then you also have the scenes of the ballet dancing, and how they're meant to maybe juxtapose one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is he saying about boxing then? Is, how does it relate to dance?
Well, dance is freaking brutal. If you ever look at a dancer's feet, like, Jesus. Mm-hmm. Except that in boxing, their bodies are being broken and you see it, right? But in dancing, their bodies are being broken, but it's done in such a beautiful way that you, and covered, that you never see the broken bodies. Mm-hmm. But it's just as gross and just as athletic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To be honest, I would be more interested in a ballet thing filmed more like boxing than the flip side here, but
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah. Mm, yeah. Well, I mean, dance is usually considered kind of an artistic medium of personal expression.
Yeah.
Whether it is or not, I couldn't say. Maybe that's kind of how he's equating it, you know?
That's what I think.
Yeah. Yeah. We might as well delve into the issue that I think really is bugging me about the movie, and possibly Mariah, and possibly Martin. Jake's relationship to women, and whether I think we do need to kind of hammer out where Scorsese stands on the issue. I do think it's important to distinguish where the filmmaker stands versus where Jake stands. Mariah,
it's hard for me to know where Scorsese stands because he's a man who's been in so many relationships, and I don't know that it's been publicized, like, why only this last one lasted more than 10 years. Mm-hmm. So for all we know, I'm not trying to say anything, but I'm hinting that maybe Scorsese's a difficult person to be with as well. I mean, he was with a lot of different women.
Yeah.
Especially in the 70s and 80s.
Well, we know he's notoriously neurotic, which I'm sure is not easy to deal with.
Yeah.
Well, and I think this film was sort of coming after a period when, like, it has been documented that he was sort of in a self-destructive spiral. And this was a little bit of his comeback film where he, I guess, got off drugs or...
got off the cocaine he was doing while filming The Last Waltz. I mean,
he nearly died on the previous film, right? Yeah. It was very serious. So, like, I don't... he probably did see something of himself in this very self-destructive character.
I think he did.
Yeah. And Jake is very neurotic, right? That's the crux of his issues. Like, he's
very insecure.
Yeah. And it's like... It's not a stretch to say that Martin Scorsese may have related to that. However, I don't think... is he an apology? Let's not base it off of anything going on in Scorsese's personal life, but just purely based on this text and his other films. How does Scorsese treat women in his films? And is that treatment an endorsement of that behavior, or is it kind of like, are we meant to be horrified by it? You know what I mean?
I mean, he shows women being attracted to dangerous men. He shows them being in love with them. He shows them being abused by them, and he shows them leaving them. But he never actually delves into the deeper layers of being that woman and why they would stay and why they finally would leave. Like, the only film he ever showed that he was truly interested in women at all was Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Mm-hmm. That's the only time you really have a full-fleshed story where you get you really know the woman. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, I don't think he disrespects women, but he definitely doesn't give them as much screen time and as much exploration as he does the psyche of men.
Yeah, it's definitely men that hit his subject. Yeah, it's...
yeah.
And I think sometimes it might vary from film to film, but just looking at this one in particular, I think there's a certain lack of point of view. And like, I'm not necessarily looking for judgment, you know. I think it's possible to have a film about, you know, very horrible or violent person, but I feel like I need at least some point of view, some perspective that I'm not necessarily getting from this film specifically.
Hmm. Yeah.
I don't think Scorsese ever really has a moral point of view. Not the way like Spielberg definitely does and kind of guides you into feeling the way he wants you to feel. Scorsese right. definitely doesn't do that. Mm-hmm. He just presents and then leaves it up to you.
I had a Romanian professor, Teresa Barta, who was like very strict that like anytime somebody said, oh, the theme of my movie is love or regret, she would say like, no, those aren't themes. A theme is like an opinion on the love yes. or the regrets. And like, I'm sort of like, I get that he's saying that, oh, it's his worst opponent is himself, but I'm not sure what Scorsese's opinion on it is. Yeah.
Yeah. I think also in my film school, that's the number one thing every teacher tried to get the students to do was, if your theme is love, it's love is what? Love is hard. Right. Love is great. Love exactly. is complicated, like whatever. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Scorsese never quite is able to be like, greed is bad. Greed mm-hmm. is fun. Like I'm thinking of Wolf of Wall Street right there. Cause greed right. is a lot of things in mm-hmm. that movie. And he maybe can't pick or
yeah,
I don't know.
No, yeah.
I
mean,
maybe like with the exception of maybe his more religious films, like I think The Last Temptation of Christ or Kundun, like you do get that, but like that's a very, maybe that's something he's very opinionated on. And that's one reason why I'm looking forward to his new film, The Silence, because I'm mm-hmm. sort of hoping for that again. But in the case of these sort of like very, you know, masculine, violent character studies, like you're right, it's sort of lacking in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, and then that's partially why some of his films are really unsatisfying, because he doesn't offer an opinion. And that's why it's really, or maybe he himself doesn't realize that his films are so morally ambiguous. Like, as you mentioned, The Wolf of Wall Street, a lot of people came away from that film feeling like Jordan Belfort is a hero. Like, it's very, very easy, because he does revel in the horrible self-destructive behavior of his characters. He clearly is enjoying filming it. He's enjoying presenting it. Like, a part of him is certainly appalled at the behavior, but another part of him really enjoys it.
Mariah, like, I think you're right in saying that, like, the Jake LaMotta character is not the character that this film should have been about, or at least not mm-hmm. from his perspective. I think you did need that extra remove, either by telling it from the point of view of one of the women in his life, or I thought even maybe the brother character, like
he's way more interesting. Yeah,
he's way more interesting. And if it was more grounded with him, like, how would you deal with having this person in your life who's dangerous, but you love him, but you know he's also sort of your meal ticket, but eventually you have to leave him, but then he wants forgiveness? Like, I felt that's maybe more with the drama was mm-hmm. than what we're seeing on screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even LaMotta as a person, like, I've read that, like, when he was a kid, his dad would make him fight other kids for money so he could help pay the rent. Like, I sort of keep asking myself, like, why tell this story in this way? I'm not sure I have a good answer.
Which makes me wonder if the onus of all this is actually on Schrader. Considering
which is possible too.
The final screenplay version. Like, there's various versions of the screenplay, and then Schrader came in and wrote a new version, and then De Niro and Scorsese added a little bit to it. Mm-hmm. But like, the meat of what we see, I think, came from Schrader's screenplay.
Well, as I said, the person who really wanted to get this made was Robert De Niro. And I think he realized that it would be a fantastic showcase for him as an actor. And it certainly is. It's a powerhouse performance.
I mean, actors love the boxing roles, you know, whether it's like Russell Crowe in Cinderella Man, or mm-hmm. Mark Wahlberg in The Fighter, or, you know, Will Smith in Ali, or Hilary Swank in Million Dollar Baby. Like, it's a mm-hmm. great type of role for an actor to really showcase physicality and heightened dramatic emotion. You know, I can see a boxing role being kind of an actor's dream role in a lot of cases.
And yet, I mean, it is a showcase for De Niro's acting right? Like, we get to see a lot of acting, both, as you say, the in the physicality, both in the fight scenes and in his later larger than life scenes. The infamous weight gain, which essentially earned De Niro an Oscar.
When I first saw this movie, I knew that it was famous for him, his body transformation. And I assumed it was because he'd gotten so fit, right? Yeah. I didn't know anything. And then we get to the part where he's like super fat. And I was like, oh my God, that's what they meant. And it was like, I was impressed, but also like, I wondered what, like, did he eat like bacon sandwiches every day or?
He apparently traveled to Europe and ate his way through Italy. So
that sounds good.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like that. It was that hard. Losing it sounds much harder.
Yes.
But
I would imagine.
Yeah, but it's probably not
that healthy.
Yeah, no, it's a terrible thing to do to your body. And the thing is, it's really not necessary.
No.
There are ways to fatten people up artificially. But, like, that's part of the method.
If they can make John Hurt look like the Elephant Man,
yeah,
they could have made him fat.
Yeah, with a bat especially suit. In black and white, it's much more forgiving as far as, like, makeup and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the whole, like, method acting, there's almost, like, a dimension of acting outside the film that sort of impresses people. It's, like, the performing outside the performance. And, like, it's a good point that, like, would this film necessarily be any different if it was, very well-done makeup instead of weight gain, if it was a fat suit that you couldn't tell? You know, I think, like, film, it's an illusion. And if you can create that illusion for the time that's on screen, then you've succeeded. It doesn't necessarily matter what's going on behind or outside of the camera, as long as it's
Murphy is still funny in The Nutty Professor when he's wearing that fat suit. That's all I'm gonna say.
That is a TKO right there, Mariah. Point made. Eddie Murphy's still funny in a fat suit. But yeah, well, okay, so I mean, aside from the methody, the stuff that is off screen, what do we think of his performance on screen? Is he captivating enough to hold this movie together? I mean, obviously not. I feel like I've just answered, after all we've been talking for the last half hour, I feel like I've just answered that question, but...
You know, I mean, he's an actor I like a lot, of course. You know, I like many of his roles. Mm-hmm. And he's clearly doing something very... technically impressive. You know, the craft is there, but I'm not entirely sure what it all adds up to.
Mm. You know, so I read this great article about method acting and how we mostly talk about male method actors and kind of ignore the women. And I would rather watch Jenna Rollins do her method, where I feel like her characters are more than just her. And I feel like I'm following a real person than this over and over, you know, like, cause I couldn't ever once think I wasn't watching De Niro.
Yeah. Really?
And I don't know if that's because, like, maybe in 1980 it was like pre, you know, De Niro and a bunch of schlock. It was easier to see him to have the performance disappear into itself. But because I grew up watching, like, one of the first De Niro movies I ever saw was Analyze This, right?
Yes.
So, like, I grew up on, like, De Niro comedies, Analyze This, and Meet the Parents, things like that. And then I watched all his, like, acclaimed, you know, New Hollywood films. And it's hard to divorce that in my brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I enjoyed him in The Intern last year more.
Ah, yeah.
Because he was like a delightful old man.
Yeah.
I'd much rather spend time with a delightful old man.
Yeah.
He does play a very good delightful old man.
He really does.
It's true.
Like, I'd rather watch a happy person. I don't know. Maybe I just want to see happy people.
it's also sort of a... not a great person, but, like, I'm maybe a little bit more captivated by his performance in King of Comedy.
Yes, I'm so glad that finally came up.
Oh, yes.
Well, like, I mean, the King of Comedy is, like, the sort of, like, I mean, talk about neurotic. That's a really neurotic character. But, like, it's sort of funny when he finally gets his shot and, like, oh, he's actually funny. And, like, I forget who made the point about, like, method acting. Like, oh, how many comedies do you see method actors doing? But, like, you know, that was a case where I think, like, I don't know, it really worked. And, like, I think De Niro is usually quite good at comedy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, he's funny. And King of Comedy is Scorsese's best movie.
Yeah, I enjoy King of Comedy. I feel like Rupert Pupkin is, like, not a bad guy. He's just confused a little. Mm-hmm. And I can relate to him more than some of these just violent, angry men, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've talked a lot. Okay, we've touched on De Niro, but there are a couple other performances I did want to mention. I know, and we've also talked about Pesci, and this is kind of his star-making role. Put him on the map.
And I love Pesci.
Yeah.
He's good.
Come back, Joe Pesci. We need you.
Yeah.
He's so good. Like, yeah. him and My Cousin Vinny.
Mm-hmm.
The Lethal Weapon movies.
Yes. Even Home Alone, he's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. I realized a lot of my mannerisms in the way I speak, especially when I'm angry, come from Angry Joe Pesci, but not like Goodfellas Angry Joe Pesci, but like Lethal Weapon complaining about little shit Joe Pesci is me.
Yeah. Yeah. And one other performance I did want to mention is Kathy Moriarty's, who I freaking love her.
I don't know if that she was supposed to be 15 when you first saw her.
Like,
15, right, I know.
15 in 1941 was definitely not 15 when I was 15.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little bit of a stretch there, but
Lauren McCall was 19 in To Have and to Have Not, and you look at that and you're like, that's 19? What was in that water?
Very true.
You know?
Very true.
People did look older back then.
They really did.
You know, the depression takes it out of you. That must be it. but Moriarty, I think, like, it's a shame because I really wish she was given more to do because I love her so much.
I mean, it's to her credit that, like, I know De Niro was throwing out a lot of improv, and they said one thing she was very good at is, like, throwing it right back at him and not getting completely steamrolled by him, which is great because he was a steamroller, obviously, on screen.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, it's I don't know. She hadn't had much acting experience, right?
Yeah, I don't think she had any.
Yeah, any. So, like, it's amazing that she can be up there and De Niro's doing this very, like, intense actory thing, and she's right there with him and doesn't budge. You know, she's...
Exactly.
Sometimes I think, like, a person who has no real professional acting, it's almost better for naturalistic performances if you can get them relaxed in front of the camera.
Right. But, which is the trick. And I get to Scorsese's credit that he was able to do that.
Yeah,
this was her. This was her debut.
Yeah,
she's in Kindergarten Cop.
Oh, yeah, she's in Casper. Do you remember Casper? She's in But I'm a Cheerleader.
Shit, I remember her. I remember her in.
She's pretty funny in But I'm a Cheerleader. Yeah.
I love her.
Yeah, she's great in that. Cheerleader.
She's the best part of that movie. I said it. Anyway, okay, well, I feel good because I feel like I want to end on Joe Pesci and Kathy Moriarty because I do think they're great. But time for the last question. This is the 53rd movie on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll. Do we think it is worthy of the 53rd spot, Mariah?
Of all time?
Of all time. No, okay.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Martin?
I feel guilty because I know so many people who like this film, but no.
Yeah. Yeah. I do. Maybe I should have, I don't know. It's a, I don't know that many people who love this movie.
I like Scorsese films. I'm not just.
No, I love certain Martin Scorsese films. I think we've talked about this, that we love the ones that are not as popular.
I've seen After Hours like 100 times. Cannot get enough of After Hours.
We already have Taxi Driver in the top 20, I think. I think it's in the top 20.
I mean, Taxi Driver, it's not my favorite, but at least I get what it's doing there.
Yeah, you know, no, like... I actually, I love Taxi Driver quite a bit. And this one, as far as exploring tortured psyches go, like, it just, it's not as interesting as it could have been. And maybe it is a matter just of personal taste. Like, I also really just generally don't care for boxing. And
Rocky is so much better than this movie. Rocky is a good man who loves his family and loves women and doesn't hurt anybody except in the ring because he knows that it's a sport.
Yeah, though I will say, to this movie's credit, like, I think we do glorify athletes in this country, and we like to think of them as being virtuous because they win sports titles. And I think, generally speaking, a lot of them are probably not great people. A lot of them probably do beat their wives. And I think it's important to spotlight that aspect of athletics, like, just how entitled people are when they reach a certain level of fame. This movie doesn't really touch on that, but I would like to see more sports movies that talk about that.
Yes.
Note we should end on is movies might be bad, but people are worse.
Yeah. Done. I love it. Okay. Well, Marty and Bobby are arguably the most renowned actor-director collaboration in cinema. They are certainly not the only pairing to receive accolades from critics and fans alike. From Lillian Gish and D.W. Griffith to John Ford and John Wayne, filmmakers and thespians have been teaming up since the beginning of cinema. And that proud tradition continues to this day with duos like Pedro Almodovar and Penelope Cruz, or Martin Scorsese and his current muse, Leo. But why do these trends continue? I understand the reasons for why directors might cast an actor over and over again. It's nice to know ahead of time that the person you're going to be working with on a months-long production is someone you can stand. But that doesn't explain why audiences seem to take so well to the repetition. For this segment, we're going to talk about why we get a kick out of seeing certain famous people teaming up for multiple projects, and we'll list off some of our favorite cinematic duos, or cinematic duets. Okay, so do you guys like it when you hear that a certain director-actor team are pairing up again? Do you get any kind of thrill out of that? And if so, why do you think that is?
I do. Because, I mean, if it's a group that I've enjoyed the previous pairing, I do. Like, so, for example, something I don't want to hear ever again is Jennifer Lawrence, Bradley Cooper, David O. Russell, because that's a load of crap, and I'm sick of it. But like, there's many, like, whenever David Lynch and Kyle MacLachlan work together, I'm like, yes, I'm into it, right? And there's some other ones where I know I'm going to enjoy them working together because I've enjoyed their previous collaborations. Yeah. So it's sort of, it depends on if I enjoyed what came previously.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Martin, how about you?
Yeah, I'm basically on the same page. I think there's like sort of a marketing aspect to it too. Like, oh, you like this previous actor working in this style by this director, then you'll like the next one. So, you know, it's it makes sense from a commercial standpoint why you would emphasize actors and directors working together over and over again. It becomes a brand, but there's definitely collaborations I could appreciate. Sometimes, even ones I love, that they sort of, a few of them seem to hit, like, either they become too comfortable with one another, or, like, you get diminishing returns in a few cases, but, you know, sometimes when you see an actor and director team where you really get the sense that they're bringing out the best of one another, that the actor is maybe the perfect subject or muse for a director, and the director knows how to shape the actor's performance into something very effective. You know, it's great. I can watch it many times when it works.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's like you mentioned Penelope and Pedro, but also early in their careers, Pedro and Antonio Banderas worked together, and then Banderas went on to be like Mr. Melanie Griffith and Zorro and all of that, and Puss in Boots, and then he hadn't really challenged himself in a while, and then he jumps into a Pedro movie again, and suddenly you're like, yes, he's such a good actor, and you get to remember what you loved about that, you know, 15 years earlier, except that I didn't see it when I was a youth. my parents were not forward thinking enough to show 4-year-old me Pedro Almodóvar.
Yeah, well, that might have been a smart parenting move. I don't know.
That's my favorite. It's Pedro Almodóvar and vaginas. A good pairing.
So true. That is the true actor or director muse. Like, greatest muse of all. Uh-huh. But yeah, I mean, anyways. I have to say a part of the reason why I love seeing actors and directors teaming up over and over again is because you get to imagine what things are like behind the scenes, and there's the kind of thrill and thinking about these people as actual people and how they might relate to each other, you know? And it's also, it gives you the illusion that, like, it is a really collaborative process. So when, you know, Julie Delpy, Ethan Hawke, and Richard Linklater work together, which they've done on numerous occasions, like, it is, you do get a sense that it is very collaborative, and they have weeks of rehearsal beforehand, and so you get a sense of like you do get like a sneak peek behind the scenes almost, or you can imagine it. So that is also kind of part of the appeal. And also, if it is a pairing that you like and that they have had a successful string of movies, there's a part of me that wants to see them continue the streak and see if they can continue their role. You know what I mean? It's almost like a sports thing. There's a sporting element to it. But let's maybe talk a little bit more about where this can go awry. There can be kind of a sense of fatigue after a while.
I mean, sort of the recent obvious examples, probably Tim Burton and Johnny Depp, like, right, that became a total joke, right? By the end, it's...
And Helena Bonham Carter.
The Johnny Depp and Burton, the work they were doing in the 90s was so good. And then, like, by the end, it seemed like... I don't know, they're bringing out, like, the worst in each other artistically. I don't know. It's maybe an example of getting too complacent, or I'm not sure what exactly, but, mm-hmm, you know, some of those are bad movies.
Yeah, no, that most of them are bad movies. Well, maybe that's not fair. Like, that is the kind of go-to, like, director-actor pairing that's, like, gotten kind of toxic. Like, when we think of that, that specific kind of dynamic, like, that's what we think of. Should we just start, maybe, do we have a top five of our favorite director-actor pairings? Should we just name them off?
Okay. I like Coppola and Dunst.
Okay.
I think they really, like, Dunst really gets Coppola's wavelength, mm-hmm, and obviously I mean Sofia Coppola here. I think they're great together, and every time I watch The Virgin Suicides, that movie is just so much better and so much more influential than I think it's given credit. Mostly because the directors that are influenced by it are women, and their films aren't watched, mm-hmm, by anybody, and so no one notices how influential she was. But I feel like it's as influential as Anderson's Rushmore. I think as many women have been inspired by Coppola as, like, indie dudes have been by Wes Anderson, but that's
okay.
That's just me. I like Ford and Wayne.
Got to.
You gotta love them.
Yep.
Unless you're Martin.
Martin, do you not love Ford and Wayne?
Oh no, I'm just more of a fan of Ford and Fonda.
Okay.
That works too.
I love Young Mr. Lincoln.
That is a good one, yes.
That's a great film.
My Darling Clementine.
That one's good, yeah.
My Darling Clementine is so good.
I love those.
Well, then I was going to say Capra, but Capra with both Jean Arthur and Jimmy Stewart.
Hear, hear.
Because, like, they're, mm-hmm, all great in all, mm-hmm, of his films. And Jimmy Stewart and everything, yeah, actually. Jimmy much. Stewart and the camera. Yeah. Can that be a duo?
Yes.
And then more recently, I really love the work David Oyelowo has been doing with Ava DuVernay. Mm. I think they really work well together.
All right.
And I hope they're supposed to do a third film together, and it keeps, she keeps doing other things, and I'm like, no, come back. Yeah. And then I like Bombach and Gerwig. I think they're great together.
Mm, okay. Those are excellent choices.
Those are my choices.
All right. Martin?
I love G.W. Pabst and Louise Brooks, two films that they made together. And, like, it's such I think, like, maybe either one on their own, like, you sort of get the sense that nobody in Hollywood really figured out what to do with Louise Brooks. And Pabst, like, he's not necessarily what I think of as, like, I don't necessarily like all of his films, but, like, those two films, it just seemed like the right fit to really bring out the best in one another. And, mm-hmm. I don't know, Pandora's Box and Diary of a Lost mm-hmm. Girl, they're so striking and powerful. I know Marcus Pinn, he suggested that not enough people mentioned Claire Denis and Alex Discasse, so I thought I'd just throw that in since that's
that one's for you, Marcus.
I feel like the really obvious one, it's probably Akira Kurosawa and Toshiro Mifune.
Yeah.
Where they made so many films together, and I kind of wish like they had maybe gotten together and made one film in their later part of their careers, but like I kind of like the idea too that it was sort of a great collaboration that ran its course, and there was no reason to maybe push it to the point where it became bad, you know, like mm-hmm. it's sort of, they made great films and then they were done. Yeah. I really like Shelley Duvall in Robert Altman's films, mm-hmm. you know.
Oh, yes. Like, mm-hmm. Yes. He's the only director who really worked with her, I think. Mm-hmm. Other than Kubrick, who'd, like, terrorized her into the performance, which I think is some bullshit. Like, Altman naturally understood her. Yeah.
I think he said when he first met her, like, he couldn't believe that she was really that earnest or that like that. He kept being like, okay, cut the act. Like, I know you're... But he said, no, she was just really Shelley Duvall.
Mm-hmm.
Wong Kar-wai and Tony Leung. I think mm-hmm. like, it's the coolest actor with the coolest director.
Mm-hmm.
That's another Tony Leung plus the camera one. It's like, he's so beautiful and he photographs so well.
I sort of contend that Tony Leung is like the last person that to me makes smoking look cool. I like Antonia Bird and Robert Carlyle. Like, I know the films they made together, like Priest and Face, and especially Ravenous. Like, I remember seeing Ravenous as a kid, and just like the sense of humor, that really dark sense of humor that he got, like it was really on her wavelength. So that's a collaboration I like.
He got her hired for that.
Yeah, it was going to be I forget the name of the director, but like somebody quit like right at the last minute, and they brought her in, and like the film wouldn't be the same without her. It's like so clearly her sensibility.
That's a good film to watch with your father.
I should watch that with my father.
I'm just saying, because I watched it with my dad and we had a really good time.
I like Paul W.S. Anderson and Mila Jovovich, and like I was thinking like how many
collaborators, yes.
like they're married, but like I know it sounds silly, but I really do kind of love the films that they make together. And just recently, you know, it's only two films in, but Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan, you know, Fruitvale Station's fantastic. And Creed, you know, another boxing film that, you know, I enjoyed from last year. I like Jean-Pierre Jeunet and Ron Perlman. That's
another one. Yes.
Ron Perlman, somebody who shows up like... I don't know, people must like working with Ron Perlman because he'll work with like the same directors a bunch of different times.
Right.
But Guillermo. I love like City of Lost Children.
I was once in the same room as Ron Perlman, and he's a very chill dude.
I don't know, he seems really cool.
He was a chill dude.
Mm-hmm.
He's also forever in my heart, the Beast.
Oh, I love The Beauty and the Beast with Linda Hamilton. It's so good, right?
Oh,
I watch that all the time.
Awesome.
I don't know. Sometimes, like, you get a actor director combination where, like, it's interesting to see like how different the gap in performance is from them working with one director to another. Like, I was thinking how much I love My Dinner with Andre and. Vanya and 42nd Street, which are both directed by Louis Malle and have Andre Gregory and Wallace Shawn. And like, it's such a great example of somebody turning the theatrical into something cinematic. You know, in theory, I feel like neither of those films should work, but they're amazing films for me. But then they did the new one with Jonathan Demme, Andre Gregory, and Wallace Shawn made the A Master Builder, and I thought it was so bad. It almost made me like angry how much I hated that film, and like it made it so apparent to me like what Louis Malle's contributions were to their previous films.
Mm. Yeah,
it's like I really love Colin Farrell and Ewan McGregor. They're two of my favorite dudes, and they were both in a Woody Allen movie back when I was still a Woody Allen fan, right? Mm-hmm. So you'd think, I'm going to love it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I fucking hated that movie. I thought it was terrible. I thought it was a waste of their talents.
Yeah.
They weren't even photographed well. I was like, Woody Allen, you clearly don't understand that part, the charm of these two actors, like, because they weren't charming in their like buoyancy, and they weren't like beautiful, and I was like, you just destroyed everything that makes them great film actors. Mm-hmm. It was very it was very frustrating.
Yeah.
To watch.
Yeah. Well, Woody Allen.
Well, like Woody Allen and Diane Wiest, I love, and her two performances are so totally different.
Yeah.
In the two films that she won her Oscars for, that it's remarkable because she's not really playing the same sort of self. Like Diane Wiest is really a character actress, so she gets to build different characters in both those films.
Yeah, well, she's just generally fantastic.
She's Diane Wiest.
I'll just throw in a couple more suggestions. Like all of yours are fantastic, but I think Dietrich and Von Sternberg is probably a pretty notable one. I personally think she would have been a star no matter what. Others disagree. Others say that so much of her persona was shaped by Von Sternberg. No one really knows, but...
That's not true because there's a film that predates their collaboration that I saw at the San Francisco Silent Film Festival a few years ago. That actually really sets up her persona.
And
then he just augments it a little bit.
No, I think she would have been Marlena Dietrich no matter what, personally. But
I think it was her.
Yeah. But I think they certainly he knew how to use that persona really well. And those seven films they made together are all pretty spectacular. Billy Wilder and Jack Lemmon, I love all those movies, basically. Some I love, some are better than others, but even Fortune Cookie. I mean, I wouldn't say I love Fortune Cookie. I like Fortune Cookie. I have issues with Avanti, but...
Right.
I haven't seen Avanti. Okay,
yeah. They're not all equal, but The Apartment and Some Like It Hot and, you know, all that. Like they made some pretty great movies together, and I'm surprised, Mariah. I was waiting for you to say Michelle Williams and Kelly Reichardt.
That's not on my list, actually. Oh God! But Kristen would be very upset if we didn't bring that up.
That's for you, so Kristen.
This is Kristen's vote.
I'm like remembering some as we go along. Like I keep thinking, like Truffaut and Leaud, or like I don't know. Yeah, there's like a Truffaut rush of like, oh, I can't believe I forgot. You know, there's laundry list of collaborations.
Can I say?
Yeah.
Can I say Jane Campion and Dix?
Yeah. if Almodovar and Vaginas can be pairing, then so can Campion and Dix. Yes.
Jane Campion and Dix.
In the interest of equal representation, yes.
Some food for thought. Yeah. I don't know.
Did she only do one film with Harvey Keitel?
Wasn't Holy Smoke?
She did two. She did two. Okay. The Piano and Holy Smoke.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
That's actually on
That's
my
a
list.
Good one.
That is on
That's
my
a good
list.
One.
Yeah. They're great together. And she's about to reunite with Nicole Kidman for Top of the Lake season 2.
I love Top of the
Lake. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And I have to say, Todd Haynes is going to do another movie with Julianne Moore, and that makes me really happy.
That's going to be four films with Julianne Moore now, right?
Yeah, I think so. Also, one more, sorry. Ozu and Setsuko Hara, because I love them. Mm. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Anyone, we can keep throwing out names. Keep going.
Oh, I didn't mention Charles Farrell, Janet Gaynor, Frank Borsagi.
Perfect. Martin, you got another one?
Wim Wenders and Natasha Kitzkinski.
Awesome. Mariah, keep going. Let's a game
Wenders
of
Wim Wenders and Bruno Gans.
Hertzog and Kinski.
Roger Corman and Vincent Price.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sammo Hung and Jackie Chan.
Yes.
Francis Ford Coppola and Pacino.
I love it. I love it. Beautiful. Okay, I think we've just about gone the distance on this episode, but before that final bell rings, I just want to give our guest Mariah a chance to talk briefly about her new project, a podcast devoted to the work of female filmmakers. Mariah, why don't you tell us the name of the podcast and what the general gist of it is?
It's called Female Filmmaker Friday, which was the name of a feature I had on my site in 2014, wherein, as it sounds, I wrote about a filmmaker every Friday, or actually, I guess I wrote about a film by a female filmmaker every Friday, and in an attempt to sort of write about some films and some directors that are maybe a little overlooked in the film verse. And that's sort of why I started A Year with Women last year, where I only watched films by women. And so during that year, I discovered even more filmmakers that I just feel like people need to know about and should be talked about and are fascinating and wonderful and interesting. And so I decided to bring all of those ideas back together in podcast form. So instead of just my opinions, I get to discuss it with other people. And for the first few shows, probably for all the shows this year, I'm keeping it to just women talking about women. I just wanted to be a space that's about women talking about women and looking at some interesting directors. So, for example, Pauline and I have discussed the work of Ida Lupino.
Yes, indeed.
That's going to be one of the shows. I also did one on Jane Campion, and I have a few others in the hopper. So I'm excited. I'm hoping to do two podcasts a month to start with. And then eventually I'd like to start having actual female filmmakers come on the show. I've put some feelers out, so we'll see.
Oh, that's exciting.
But if you're a lady director or a producer or an editor, I don't care, cinematographer, and you're like, hey, I want to talk about my craft, like, give me a call. Mm-hmm. Probably an email, actually, not a call.
Okay, yeah.
drop me a line, at me.
Yeah.
we'll talk about it.
I'm happy to help gather people. Let's get some female filmmakers on. I like that.
Okay.
So, yeah, look for it on iTunes, right?
Yeah, okay. Yes.
Hopefully, yeah. All right, yes. Yeah, look for it on iTunes and all the podcatchers.
SoundCloud.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. All right. Awesome. And that's the way we frame it. Flix-wise, that is. Listeners, what do you think of Raging Bull? come let us know on our website, flixwise.com, or you can come share your thoughts on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/flixwise and like us and give us your hot takes. And if you want to talk to me directly, no knocking down any doors required, just follow me on Twitter. The handle is @FlixWise. But before you do all of that, don't be as useless as an overcooked steak. Please go to iTunes, rate us, and leave us a nice review before I punch your lights out.
Oh, no.
Because violence. I know. I can't. No. No one's going to buy that. Just do it because you're a good person and it's the right thing to do.
We'll make you not pretty anymore.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure people are quaking in their boots. remind me to never mess with you, Mariah.
I got a mean sucker punch, yep. Is all I'm saying.
I believe it. On our next show, we might have yet another FlixWise favorites entry for you. Martin and I are looking into doing Story of a 3-Day Pass, the Melvin Von Peebles film. Otherwise, we have Fritz Lang's M coming up on the Sight and Sound list, so keep an eye out for that one as well. Until then, Mariah, thank you so much for coming on and talking Scorsese with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Martin, you can come out of character now.
Finally.
Never! all right, guys. Gotta fly now? Da-da-da!
You know, I gotta go hang out with the Eye of the Tiger.
Yeah! Dirt! Dirt, dirt, dirt!
You like girl fights?
Girl fight's good. Yeah, girl fight's pretty good.